Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all for coming. Welcome to the launch of this new CER report, which is The Future of Europe's Economy, Disaster or Deliverance, which has generously been hosted by the European Institute here at the LSE. My name is Simon Tilford from the CER, and I'm going to be moderating, I hope moderating rather than refereeing, today's discussion. The CER is very grateful to all four contributors who have given their time to contribute to this report and also for coming today to launch it. It's very rare to have all the contributors of a report together in one place to launch it. The first, Paul de Gore, needs little introduction. He's the John Paulson Chair of European Political Economy here at the LSE, the European Institute. George Magnus is the former Chief Economist at UBS, now an independent economist and consultant. Thomas Meyer, again, former Chief Economist at Deutsche Bank, now a Senior Fellow at the Centre of Financial Studies at the Goethe Universität in Frankfurt. And Holger Schmieding, who's Chief Economist of Berenberg Bank, which is Germany's oldest private bank. Before we kick off, I'd like to make a couple of brief announcements. The first is that please put all your mobile phones on silent. The second is that the event is hopefully being recorded and that this should be made available online. And thirdly, the Twitter hashtag is #LSE_CER. I'm going to ask Paul to kick off for no other reason than alphabetical order.
Okay, thank you very much, Simon. I'm very pleased to be here and to kick off this discussion. I've called my intervention Governance of the Eurozone, Creditor Nations Rule Supreme in the Eurozone. The legacy of the Euro crisis is that it has led to a split of the Eurozone into creditor and debtor nations. And let me quickly show you some evidence here. This is the accumulated current account surpluses and deficits, right? I start in 1991, and so accumulate the current account deficits or surpluses, and that then gives a net debt or creditor situation vis-à-vis the rest of the world. And you can see this divergence within the Eurozone that has accelerated during the time of the Eurozone, where some countries have become creditor nations, right? In particular, Belgium, Germany, Netherlands, and Finland. And then others who were booming in the past have become debtor nations because the boom was one of consumption boom, excessive spending, and therefore large current account deficits. And they have become the debtor nations. So that's quite important to realize this split that has occurred in the Eurozone, right? And the implication, one of the implications of this has been that the creditor nations have imposed their rule. It's always like that. The creditor nations rule supreme. Thou shalt repay thy debt. Right? And the Commission has imposed that rule on the rest of the Eurozone, on the debtor nations. And in order to achieve that, austerity has been imposed. Austerity allows to generate a surplus that can then be transferred to the rich creditor nations. Right? So that has been the whole ball game that has been imposed by the creditor nations. But of course, it also has created an asymmetric adjustment mechanism. The debtor nations have had to do the adjustment by austerity, right, without compensating stimulus by the creditor nations. And that has resulted in a deflationary bias that we have seen in the last few years, a renewed recession, now zero growth, essentially, and the question is how long this will last. Let me show you this asymmetry in the adjustment process. Here I show you what is called the relative unit labor costs of the debtor nations. Right? So the relative unit labor cost is the unit labor cost of the country involved relative to the rest of the Eurozone. So when it goes up, it means that unit labor costs increase faster in that country than in the rest of the Eurozone. When it goes down, it's the other way around. So you can see that the debtor nations up to 2008 experienced an upward movement in that line, indicating that prices and wages increased faster because of the local boom, and that led to a loss of competitiveness. And since the crisis, they have had to adjust. And you can see how spectacular the adjustment has been, except for Italy. For some reason, Italy doesn't have to do that. Something special about that country. But all the others have gone through what's sometimes called an internal devaluation, which means cut wages, right? And this has led to a deep recession, high increasing unemployment. So they have done all the adjustment. What did the creditor nations do? Nothing. Here I show you the same relative unit labor cost. You would have expected that they would stimulate their economies so that their lines would go up now since the crisis. It has not happened. So all the burden of the adjustment has been put on the debtor nations. They had to suffer. One of the striking features of this legacy is that despite these intense austerity programs, there is no evidence that these countries that have had to endure this have increased their capacity to service their debt. That's what you would expect, right? When you go through this medicine of austerity, that at the end of the day, you can generate more resources to service the debt, right? But what you see is that the debt-to-GDP ratio, the government debt-to-GDP ratio, is on an explosive path. So at the end of the austerity, today, they are weaker. They have less resources to service their debt than before, right? So that doesn't sound very good. So I think this is unsustainable. The debt accumulation that has been going on in these countries will put so much pressure on the political systems, political and social system, that it is not sustainable. Especially when it is recognized that all this, that the benefits of the austerity, right, the surplus that has to be generated, is going towards the rich creditor nations. Politically, this will not be acceptable. And therefore, these countries will be pushed into default. What are the options for the future? Well, here I list three options. One I call symmetric budgetary policies. The other one, debt monetization. And I think Thomas is going to pursue on this line about debt monetization. And then debt default or restructuring or whatever name you want to give to it. I think one and two could be implemented, but are unlikely to be. Right? We may differ there about the forecasts, but I think it's going to be very difficult to do. Symmetric budgetary policies, by that I mean that the adjustment cost would be borne symmetrically, that the creditor nations do also something that is stimulate the economy so as to alleviate the burden on the debtor nations, but I don't think this is very likely. Debt monetization is another option where the ECB, in fact, in the context of its OMT program, would buy debt of the debtor nations and then write it down, put it in the shredding machine or something, right? But that creates fears of inflation. In my paper, I argue that we shouldn't have too many fears of inflation because at this moment, given that we have the zero bound of the interest rate, I think some debt monetization is possible, but I think the phobias that exist in a number of countries about this are so strong that this is not likely to happen, and therefore the only alternative option is debt restructuring, rescheduling, forgiveness, however you may want to call this. Here I show you the debt Laffer curve because it's something we might want to have in our mind. What does that mean? Well, on the horizontal axis, I set out the stock of the outstanding debt. And on the vertical axis, the expected debt repayment. So this is a debt Laffer curve. Laffer is an American economist who invented the Laffer curve in a different context, but this here has been called the dead Laffer curve. Countries that are in trouble, right, have the following feature. If the creditors impose full repayment, that is, they want to get everything back, then the probability that they will be repaid is very low. In fact, can become zero. So there is an optimal level of debt, and therefore also debt relief, the difference between B and A, that from the point of view of the creditors is optimal, that maximizes what they can expect to get back. So a rational creditor that is confronted with a debtor that is having great difficulties in repaying the debt may in fact, instead of insisting you have to pay back the full debt, may in fact say, well, let's do some debt relief. That's better. We will get more of this. So it's a rational calculus where you are nice to the debtor because it's in your interest to be nice to the debtor. Will that? So I would say this is what should happen. Will that happen? I think it's unlikely. One of the reasons is that a large part of the debt is now held by public institutions in the creditor nations. And here, rational thinking becomes difficult because, as you may know, in northern European countries, you have this Manichaean view that there is good and evil in the world. The good is in the north of Europe. The evil is in the south of Europe. So therefore, the southern European countries should suffer, should be punished for their sins. And that makes it politically very difficult to say, we will be nice to you and we will relieve your debt. It doesn't fit in this Manichaean view of the world that exists in these countries. And therefore, I think it's not going to be easy to do. In the end, default will be inevitable. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Paul. So basically, what we have in Europe is a debt crisis, and the best way of solving a debt crisis in the interest of both the creditors and the debtors is to write down a good proportion of that debt, and that's not happening in Europe so far. Good. George Magnus.
Thank you very much. Well, I'm not sure that I'm comfortable with answering the question about deliverance or disaster, which was obviously couched in the title of the papers, but I'll try and summarise the framework. So there is obviously some good news at the moment. It's good news that, you know, it's been a year since Angela Merkel supported Draghi's virtual OMT plan to backstop sovereigns. It's good news that the cyclical indicators in Europe are picking up. It's good news that the pace of austerity, at least as measured by the structural fiscal impulse, is going to be zero next year for the first time since 2010. So the pace of austerity obviously is fading for the moment. And it's good news from the point of view of Europe that debtor countries have, for the most part, been pretty quiescent and swallowed their medicine not willingly, but certainly well. But I think the future of Europe actually is about radically different things. And inevitably, these are very, very heavily tinged with politics for two reasons. The first is, as Paul has kind of referred to, that the crisis has accentuated and revealed long-standing weaknesses in Europe's demography, competitiveness, productivity, financial architecture. And obviously, it's revealed all these things and split Europe between north and south, undermining trust, which is kind of pretty important. And the other actually is if the Eurozone actually does make progress in integrating, probably against my judgment, to be honest, but if it does make radical progress in integrating, it's going to make the EU as an organising force completely redundant. And obviously that'll have significant implications for countries like the UK. Either way, it's going to be a very, very difficult economic transition. So I'd like to comment on six points, really, that Europe has to overcome if deliverance is kind of to be the answer. The first is the ubiquitous consequences of rapid population ageing are clearly gathering momentum. In the next 10 years, Germany, Spain, Italy, one-third of all European regions defined by the Commission will have population decline. The working age population will drop by almost 2%. The old age dependency ratio will rise from 26 to 32% en route to 50% by the middle of the century. And apart from the implications of this, which are to lower Europe's potential growth rate very significantly, it's obviously posing an increasing challenge to Europe's social model and welfare affordability. And further, significant increases in structural fiscal balances, despite the heavy lifting of the last 3 years, further very, very significant increases in fiscal balances will be required to cope with age-related spending and so on. So it's quite premature to say this is the end of austerity. This is the end of the first phase of austerity. The rest is still ahead. The second point is that Europe suffers from extraordinarily low employment rates. So that the average employment rate in Europe is just now below 69%, but in Spain and Italy it's about 60%, in Greece it's 55%, and this compares with, say, 75% in Germany. These sharp differences, of course, are even more visible when you compare employment of women and employment of workers aged over 55. So it really is kind of a tale of, you know, two continents, as it were, when it comes to demographic structure. The third point is that income growth is being suppressed, as elsewhere, like in the UK and the US, by globalization and technology and automation, but it's also being institutionalized by the austerity regime. So, for example, new forms of wage policy intervention and big changes in collective bargaining have become embedded in the surveillance and monitoring systems that have been introduced. They penalize countries that exceed wage cost guidelines, but they don't penalize countries that fail to reach those wage cost guidelines. So it's skewed, again, much to echo my predecessor, it's skewed in favor of the creditors as opposed to the debtors. The fourth point is that productivity growth in advanced economic sectors in Europe has been lagging for some time, particularly against the United States in ICT, innovation, and enterprise research and development. And Europe has very, very significant weaknesses by comparison in extracting, with the exception of, say, Germany and Sweden, maybe, and the UK, of extracting commercial value from non-physical types of investment, you know, brands, IPR, design, marketing, business structures, and so on and so forth. It also has quite serious shortfalls in human capital investment. So if you look at kind of tertiary enrollment in the United States vis-a-vis Europe, if you look at upper secondary school levels of attainment in Europe vis-a-vis the United States, it's quite clear that Europe is way behind in many respects, which suggests that the problem in Europe is not so much about labor market rigidities as skills mismatch, which is a different topic altogether. Fifth, the euro crisis, obviously, which we've already heard and will hear more about, clearly has had this effect of thickening the wedge between north and south. And I think that, you know, the economic crisis and the persistence of default and funding risks actually is far from over. So we've already, I don't want to go too much into kind of Paul's comments already, but you know, there's no strategy for symmetric macroeconomic adjustment. I mean, Germany, you know, doesn't have to be a Keynesian country, but, you know, the share of consumption in GDP in Germany has been 56% for 20 years, pretty flatlining, so there's no, you know, very low compared with other countries. The labor share of national income today is lower than it was when monetary union was formed. The idea of building a kind of a Eurozone comprised of mini Germanies obviously is pretty impossible and quite damaging, not the least of which is obviously because it's just not possible for all countries to run current account surpluses unless there's going to be a global boom, which there isn't. One of the things that really kind of also makes me feel that we're being kind of led astray a little bit. If you saw Wolfgang Schäuble's article in the FT a couple of days ago, kind of reminded me of it, actually, is the kind of, what I think is the kind of self-delusion that Germany's labor market reforms actually were the key to Germany's economic success, and therefore, if it worked for Germany, then it'll work for other countries as well. I think it's a delusion because, A, I think Germany's economic success was due to a lot of things, but not due to the labour market reforms per se. And the labour market reforms, when they took place, were hardly regarded as groundbreaking at the time. They didn't really affect collective bargaining, working time hours, or hiring and firing flexibility. And they actually arguably left Germany as the low-wage capital of Europe, with 8 million people in low-paid jobs or mini-jobs. That's about a fifth or a quarter of the workforce. So this is not a model that I think will transfer well to the rest of Europe that lacks Germany's other advantages. And last but not least, banking union, clearly a vital institutional innovation by most people's benchmarks to sever the infamous links between weak banks and weak sovereigns. But I can't see a very strong chance of an effective joint liability and adequately backstopped banking union any more than I can see the kind of debt mutualization or institutional transfers that Paul alluded to. And finally, Europe faces a pretty chilly international background against which to manage its relative decline. So by 2020, the share of Europe's share of global GDP growth may be down to about 15%, 10% in the case of the Eurozone. American competitiveness is rising in both labor costs and in non-labor cost phenomena. Clearly, Europe has actually increased its exports to the BRICS and other emerging markets quite sharply. But China is now more a competitor than a kind of a trading market in some respects, and the benefits of trade with emerging countries has gone unequivocally to largely to Germany, which now accounts for about 50% of EU exports to China and the bulk of EU exports to Eastern Europe, apart from which, over the next 5 to 10 years, the whole kind of emerging market background is going to look rather more pedestrian and much more tepid as growth slows down, in some cases, for example, in China, quite materially. And so to conclude, I mean, I think it's quite churlish for me to say that it's not possible for, you know, the biggest economy in the world with Europe's sophisticated institutions and world-class companies to basically reinvent itself and create a new kind of model. And perhaps that suggests that deliverance is the kind of labored but long-term outcome. Against that, if you think about the competitiveness challenge, the demographics, the productivity weaknesses, and the political and economic consequences of the euro crisis, I think it's hard to dispute that they're colluding to form the biggest threat to Europe's economy and the legitimacy of its institutions since the 1930s. And in this context, I have to say that the cyclical bounce that we're seeing at the moment doesn't give me much confidence that some sort of disastrous scenario is avoidable, even if it may not be an endgame. Thank you.
Thank you very much, George. I mean, you seem to agree with much of Paul's analysis of the way the Eurozone crisis has been handled, but argue that the crisis has collided with some serious underlying problems in Europe to produce a sharp slowdown in growth potential, which ultimately could threaten the legitimacy of the region's political institutions.
Yeah, I just think a lot of these problems predate the euro crisis. And were certainly the subject of concern by the Commission and European governments since Lisbon 2010. But actually, nothing really much happened to bring Lisbon 2010 about. Europe 2020 expressed many of the same kind of objectives. But, you know, the power to do this is with national governments. And for various reasons, not least of which the euro crisis, I think the ability of national governments to cohere around a common agenda has been badly undermined.
Thomas Mack.
Yeah, good afternoon. When Simon asked me to look at the EU in 2020, I took this task very literally. So when you read my contribution in the booklet, I beamed myself forward into 2020, found that things had stabilized, and explained from the perspective of 2020 how we got there. Now, I have a slight problem in maintaining this narrative here, because if I would beam myself now forward into 2020, I would immediately disappear from this lecture. So therefore, I would like to give you this talk from the present perspective. So I would encourage you to read the backward-looking perspective from 2020 in the booklet. But from a present perspective, I think We have to change. We have to change things so that things can stay the same. This is a quotation out of one of my favorite Italian novels. And I think this applies to the European Union. For the European Union to stay the same, to remain about freedom, democracy, economic prosperity in the 21st century that it was all about, it needs to change in structure. We need to adopt structures that were created in the 20th century to achieve these laudable objectives of the 21st century. And we haven't really been doing so far a great job. We built a European currency that looked a bit like the 19th century gold standard. In this chart, I've put down four objectives, which I think are the ones you should pursue to create a stable monetary system: price stability, fiscal discipline, financial stability, economic flexibility. When we have all these, things should go reasonably well for the currency that you built in that system. At the euro area level, we really established only one institution to look after these objectives, namely the ECB. The ECB was given the objective of price stability, and this is why I have them in this chart with a straight arrow. The other objectives were in the Maastricht Treaty left to governments to pursue at the national level. We did not quite trust them, so this is why, as an afterthought, we introduced the Stability and Growth Pact, which therefore I put in here with a curved arrow. It's not really part of the original system. It was like a 19th century gold standard with an intelligent gold mine called ECB and with the obligations of the members to really live in this gold standard. Now, as we know, this is a demanding system. As we know from history, the gold standard had severe crises and countries dropped out of them. In the first 10 years of EMU, countries did not live up to the requirements that you need to perform well in such a system. So we had a crisis between 2010 and the middle of 2012, which resembled the classical balance of payments crisis in gold standards. This is about high drama. Oh my God, I run out of gold. I'm going to default now if I do not get a loan. Some of you may have read this wonderful book, Lords of Finance, where it is described how desperate they were in the early 30s to get a loan. Give me gold. So we ran through this. We tried to help the countries, bring them back to virtue, do the right things to live in a gold standard, give them temporary adjustment loans, but it did not do the trick. By spring 2012, the risks were on the wall that some countries would drop out. We talked about Grexit, people talked about Pexit, Portugal exit, and there was the fear that this whole wonderful system, this gold standard, would go the way the old gold standard had gone. What to do? Well, if the gold standard does not work for all countries, but you want to keep all countries in EMU, then you change the model. You go away from the gold standard. You go away from what an economist that is in Germany famous, but probably here is not even known. You go away from what Walter Eucken, a liberal economist in Germany, called a commodity money system, over to a state debt money system. You build a state central bank that together with a state issues money basically as a state liability. With that, you can keep everyone in. That works. The drama goes away. This is why, since the middle of 2012, when Mrs. Merkel and Draghi, in a co-production, built what I call the Euro Shadow State and coupled this with the Euro Shadow Bank, this is why the drama went away. No more gold standard-like dramas. But are we on safe ground? No. This is the Euro Shadow State that Mrs. Merkel built. A web of treaties that is hellishly complicated. This is a simplified version of the web of treaties to achieve, again, these different objectives. I will not walk you through in detail through this. Otherwise, it would take me the next 15 minutes, and I'm sure that Simon would not like me to steal this time from the others. It's hellishly complicated, it's overdetermined, and it will not work. Because the Euroshadow government, the European Council, the Euroshadow executive, the Eurogroup, and the task force, the Troika, the descent out into the regions to make things work, they are not accepted. People reject it. They don't follow the commands of the shadow state. The French say no. The Italians say we cannot. And the Greeks say, yes, 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 we try, but, you know, what shall we do? So it's not working. It's not working. So what have we done? We have built a state central bank, the ECB, with a paper tiger state. It's not working. If you have a state central bank and no state authority, you end up in a regime that resembles the ruble zone of the early 90s. When the Soviet republics gave up, became sovereign again, Soviet Union fell down. They kept the ruble, they kept the Soviet central bank system as a state central bank, issuing state debt money, but they couldn't regulate access to the central bank's balance sheet, and it became basically a self-service store. And the ruble zone disintegrated by the stronger countries leaving, because the weaker ones said, we need more credit in order to survive. And the Soviet central bank did whatever it took to help them. So we have a problem here. This problem will come to the fore, not now, in some time, because we shifted the adjustment issue from the debtor countries that Paul was saying where it has been up to now, over to the creditor countries. With this, we took the drama of the gold standard away. We kicked the can down the road a lot. This was a saying that we always used during 2010-11, kick the can down the road. It was a month, a quarter in this quasi-gold standard regime. Now we kicked it down a couple of years. So fast forward in my essay to 2015. By 2015, everyone is unhappy. Everyone is unhappy. The Germans complain about the inflation that this has caused them, because the ECB needed to take care of the weaker links. The British complain that by building this house for the euro area in the larger house of the EU, they've wrecked the building EU. The inhabitants that are not part of this feel that they have been shortchanged. They have been dealt with very badly. They want to move out. They don't want to live with this construction in the EU house. In 2015, the EU is in a deep, deep crisis. We have a big council meeting in 2015 where they realize if we don't do something drastic, the EU will really fall apart. Britain will walk out, Sweden will walk out, Germany will exit the euro, and so on. So they decide you have to change things to keep things the same. You have to change the structure to retain the European ideas. So what do? You rebuild the house. You acknowledge that not everyone can be in this euro, in this straitjacket. You let the Latin European countries, I say Latin because I want to include France. I want to include France. You let the Latin European countries live with the euro and let the ECB decide what it needs to do to keep them happy. And you take the Central and Northern European countries out of the euro by allowing them to introduce a parallel currency to the euro. Not in cash, in book form. As book money. You open the European house and allow others, the UK, Sweden, others, to live in this house, taking benefit of a single European market without being dragged into these family affairs of those who keep the currency. And this is EMU 3.0. After EMU 2.0, in which we presently live, and the EU in 2020. which I sort of found when I bring myself forward to 2020 and where I describe in writing the way to. You change the EU in a EU European Union free trade area. The difference of that with the free trade area as such is that you have to be democratic and subscribe to certain values to get into the EU FTA. You have, as you can see, a Euro group with Euro-pre-ins that tick more Latin. And you have a Central and Northern group, Central and Northern European group, with Central and Northern European pre-ins, which tick more, let's call it Germanic. They both can agree to keep the euro as cash. This is the political symbol on which we can agree. If you are an inhabitant of Sen country, well, you would have on your account the Sen euro, but if you needed cash, you go to the cash machine and take out the euro notes, and they will not burn a hole into your pocket, because unlike in the Weimar Republic, the inflation rate will not be 50,000% per year. So you can do that. But you keep your money safe in your Sen euro account. So this is my vision for the EU in 2020. Things need to change so that things can remain the same.
Thank you very much, Thomas, for that fascinating presentation. So as things stand, you see the Europe as a threat to stability in Europe. And in order to save the monetary union and limit the damage to the EU, the Eurozone has to be split, essentially, into two blocks, two currency blocks. Thank you. August meeting.
Can you help me?
Yes.
Get the presentation out. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm definitely on the deliverance side. Shortly after Maggie Thatcher came to power in this country, I had the pleasure of studying at the London School of Economics. I tell you, Thatcher was not popular. The first results of Thatcher were record unemployment, street protests, and letters of protest from eminent economists that all that she was doing is utter nonsense. 10 years ago, in Germany, Gerhard Schröder introduced Agenda 2010. The first results of Schröder were record unemployment, street protests, and howls of protest, especially globally, that Germany should change tack. Germany needs a fiscal stimulus, not labor market reforms or other nutty things. Well, history has proven Thatcher and Schröder right. When you now see in the Euro periphery, street protests and record unemployment. It is bad, but it does not mean that it will fail. Actually, no pain, no gain seems to be the norm in structural economic reforms. Can I enlarge that? Okay, now we see it better. Okay, to the euro crisis. Why actually does the eurozone have a debt crisis? What you see here is the change in public debt ratios relative to the start of the euro in the eurozone, the US, and the UK. The one region which actually had a declining ratio of public debt to GDP until Lehman struck was the eurozone. And post-Lehman, the region with by far the smallest increase in public debt ratios is the eurozone. Yes, Spain would be pretty close to the UK on that chart. Italy would be very well below the eurozone average on that chart as to the rise in debt-to-GDP ratios. It can't just be public debt as a reason why the eurozone is having the crisis. The story of the euro crisis is very simple. What you see here is that global manufacturing, here split into US, China, and the eurozone. Manufacturing is highly integrated across the world. It normally moves pretty much in lockstep. But in the middle of 2011, the eurozone decoupled to the downside from the rest of the world. That was the start of the euro crisis, not the Greek crisis. Greece is tiny. The euro crisis started in the middle of 2011. Until then, the eurozone had enjoyed trend growth. The decision to restructure Greek debt without providing a safety net for Spain and Italy shattered confidence. The result was recession in the eurozone, including stagnation in Germany, and mounting trouble. Then, all of a sudden, in the middle of last year, everything changed. The problem was after the Greek debt restructuring, when Spain and Italy got into trouble in markets, there was no safety net for them. There was no lender of last resort. When the ECB finally stepped forward in this country, in this town, in late July 2012, and said, actually, like in other regions of the world, the central bank is the lender of last resort. We are no longer holier than thou. We are just like the Bank of England, if need be. We can be a lender of last resort. When the ECB said that, things turned. As you can see, ever since, the eurozone leading indicator has gone up nicely. Market tensions have subsided. Now that the eurozone has fixed the one single significant institutional deficiency, the lack of a lender of last resort, everything else is second rate. Now that the eurozone has fixed that, things are improving quite nicely. And the improvement is not confined to the eurozone core. What you see here is a slightly different index, economic sentiment for the eurozone as a whole and for the periphery. They both turned at roughly the same time, the middle of last year, and they've turned up nicely. The eurozone periphery is now on the verge of economic growth. From the incomplete data we have, we can deduce that Portugal, Ireland and Greece had quarter-on-quarter increases in their GDP in the second quarter, plus a further rise in leading indicators thereafter. Knock a lot on wood, things can go wrong in life, but the euro periphery is on the right track. Which you can see, for instance, here. This is the current account of the euro periphery. That is a massive external adjustment. The latest data, we today got July data for Greece, suggests that by now the current account surplus of the euro periphery is about close to 2% of their GDP. Another up leg in that line. Greece is, contrary to what I had written here late last week, Greece is not on track to balance its current account, 12-month average, by late 2013. It almost did so in July. It will almost certainly have done so with the data for August. There is rapid adjustment, and slightly more than half of the aggregate adjustment comes from more exports, slightly less than half from less imports. Well, belt tightening after a party, unfortunately, is part of it. The real unit labor cost adjustment has been mentioned. I'm not going to go into that. What I consider very important is this. This is an indicator of actual structural reforms. Have you loosened dismissal rules? Have you cut pension entitlements? All this nasty stuff. Yes, one would be doing a lot, zero would be doing nothing. Greece, Ireland, Portugal, and Spain are the leaders in Europe, with Estonia, who had their own crisis a while ago. There is serious structural change at the periphery. Just as there was serious change in Britain under Thatcher, in Germany under the Agenda 2010. Painful, but it tends to work in the end. Now the German story, and that's where actually I very much disagree, George, sorry about that,
sure.
With what I heard about that. What you see here is the longer run trend in good employment, not the very funny tiny jobs. Employment where you earn enough to be subject to payroll taxes, unfortunately. That's the cutoff line. There was a long-established trend, very long trend, of a decline in that employment. Germany was going for the abyss, going for broke 10 years ago. If you ever have ever less people paying into the welfare system, there's nothing you can do about it except go broke, unless you change. Then came the labor market reform. So this was not cyclical. It had nothing to do with climate.
This was not cyclical. It was a long-established trend. Then came the labour market reforms of early 2004, mostly implemented. It took 2 years for them to work. I mean, when you have street protests and uncertainty, you don't hire people, even if your labour market is a bit looser. But from early 2006 onwards, we have seen a rapid increase. And you see over here, that was the Lehman recession. This is not cyclical. It has nothing to do with global demand. That is it. Sea change in the German labour market thanks to structural reforms. But we don't know yet whether the Spanish labour market will eventually deliver similar results. We don't know. But at least they have a structural reform, and we know from experience that can work. So to conclude my remarks, Europe 2020. I think we will, by 2020, have been reaping a lot of the rewards of the current pain. Britain has been changed for good by Margaret Thatcher. We still, especially in this city, but well beyond it in this country, owe a lot to her reforms. Without them, Britain wouldn't be such a prosperous place. Europe 2020 will be a better place due to the reforms that are being enacted now, which are very painful. But, well, that's the thing. We are already now in the Eurozone, I think, at a point where the worst in terms of economic pain is either over or close to over. The biggest apparent flaw in the design of the Eurozone, the lack of a lender of last resort, has been healed. I know, there's a lot of other stuff. Yes, and it's complex, yes. But I guess the rule book for many other countries and regions of the world isn't very simple either. The Eurozone has improved its governance structure. We don't know whether the new stability pact, the debt break, the six-pack, the two-pack will actually work. They probably won't work very well, but they'll probably work a little. Relative to other regions of the world, which do not have anything constraining the rise in public debt, and probably relative to the old version of the Eurozone stability pact, that's likely to be an improvement. My guess remains that, despite problems, and I don't want to talk about France now, that would take an extra minute too long. Despite obvious problems such as France, the Eurozone will emerge stronger and more dynamic from the crisis, just as Britain and Germany did from their own adjustment crisis. And as a result of that, the Eurozone is more likely to shrink, more likely to expand than to shrink, despite risks, of course, in Greece and Cyprus. Changing tack a bit, if the Eurozone does not implode but actually gets out of its crisis stronger than before, Britain will face an interesting choice. What will Britain do? I think the choice over here is between either staying in Europe or the abyss. I may be exaggerating a little, I know. But London is simply in the wrong time zone to be the services centre of Asia. London either stays in good touch with its market, Europe, or London will have to downsize. So my guess is that London, Britain, will stay in the EU, in the common market, will not obstruct whatever happens in the Eurozone. They will ask for a few opt-outs, they will get a few opt-outs in the coming negotiations. And outside the Euro, but inside the common market, Britain will continue to thrive. Just as a risk, if Britain were to choose to leave the EU, I think the result would be a marginalised England, politically, economically, with London losing much of its lustre, and Scotland leaving the UK. Risks to my positive deliverance scenario, I know, are serious. Risks in life always exist. I could get out, step out of this house, and be hit by a bus. So the risks are there, we have to be aware of them. But I don't think that their probability is more than, say, 30%. With significant probability, make it 70%. I do think that in Europe, we are by and large on the right track towards a stronger Eurozone and a Britain that will stay a reliable partner in Europe. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Holger. Some optimism. So So basically, as long as the pressure on the struggling countries is kept up, they will start reaping the rewards of these reforms, and by 2020, things should look relatively stable, notwithstanding various risks. But you're much the most optimistic of the four contributors, yeah?
Yeah, I would say, actually, as long as the peripheral countries do not backtrack,
yeah,
we don't have to force them to do much more. They just have to stay with their new regime. Then I think we will, much before 2020, emerge stronger from this. By 2020, we'll all be looking back at this, okay, it was pain, but it was worth it.
It was worth it. Well, thank you very much to all four of you. As an economist myself, I'm somewhat ambivalent about economists taking such diametrically opposed positions to the same question. It makes it easier for policymakers to ignore everything we say. Now, I'm going to exploit my position as chair here just to put a very quick question to each of the four contributors before I open up to the floor. I'm going to start with Paul. Are things really as bad as you suggest? Is it not the case that countries are now finally pushing through reforms which they have delayed for very long periods of time? Wouldn't less fiscal discipline, debt monetisation, allow the struggling economies to ease back on these reforms just as they're starting to deliver benefits?
Well, yes, of course, it is true that these countries have to go through austerity and reform, and they are doing that. They've done, and if we have seen the data, they've done a lot of structural reforms. But the issue is whether all this will be sufficient. And I want to quickly react also to what Holger was saying when he referred to Thatcher and Germany. Let's not forget that this was all made possible in the case of the UK with the great depreciation of the currency, right? All these success stories that we have about austerity are countries that imposed austerity together with the depreciation of the currency. That also has happened in Scandinavian countries that had a similar problem. In the case of Germany, right, the reason why Germany got out so easily is that the rest of the Eurozone was booming. In other words, we had symmetry at that time. Germany was doing austerity, and the rest of the Eurozone was booming. Now, we ask the southern European countries to do austerity, and the others don't want to move. That makes it different, right? And then the metaphor of, well, we have to suffer, and after some pain, things will look better, I think is a little cheap. We should follow policies in the Eurozone that recognize the need to do austerity in the south, but makes all this more palatable by doing the opposite in the north. That would have been the right policy approach. And whether now we should be optimistic or pessimistic, I was surprised by Holger's optimism, and I really hope he's right. Huh? What can I say? Of course, I hope he's right, but given the debt overhang, and here one, there's a danger of using averages. Holger was using the average debt to GDP ratio of the Eurozone and see, well, it didn't increase that much, and it's lower than the UK and all that. It reminds me of the problem of averages when you want to cross a river that is 1.5 meter deep on average, but in the middle it's 4 meter deep. And you tell the people, well, it's on average 1.5 meter deep, so you can safely cross. It will be a problem, right? That's a little bit the issue that I see here. The debt explosion in these countries is still going on. And we will have to do something about this and just hope that if they have some more pain, they will get out of this like others have done in the past. I think maybe a little bit too optimistic.
Thanks, Paul. I'm sure members of the audience will want to come back to variations of that question. George, I'd like to ask a question about the Eurozone and trade. The members are doing a falling proportion of their trade with other members of the Eurozone because their exports to non-Eurozone economies are rising much more quickly than their exports to one another. One of the arguments in favour of a single currency, or one of the the criterion for a successful currency is that it is between countries that do most of their trade with one another. Is this a problem, what we're seeing, and what can they do to address it?
Well, I don't think it's... I mean, it's not an immediate problem that requires, you know, an answer tomorrow. And, you know, in terms of, you know, the optimal currency area, yes, you know, it does make a difference over time if all countries increasingly trade outside of the area, and also if only one or two countries, in this particular case Germany, is actually blazing a trail in terms of increasing its trade with China and you know, Eastern Europe and other emerging countries. As I said in the kind of formal remark and in the paper, you know, Germany accounts for almost 50% of EU exports to China, and a higher proportion of the growth in exports to China and the BRICS over the last few years. So that does make a difference, because obviously for Germany, financial arrangements, you know, the quote shadow Deutschmark RMB rate is much more important than, you know, competitiveness considerations vis-a-vis, you know, Italy or maybe even France. So over time, I think it makes a difference because actually the country's focus will be shifted towards economic and financial metrics that actually are outside of the member countries. So it gives Germany and other countries that can keep up with Germany a kind of a stronger incentive, as it were, to kind of to look, you know, beyond the confines of what they might feel is the confines of a narrower Eurozone. So I think, you know, to take Thomas's kind of scenario, actually, it kind of would support, you know, an outcome that looks like that. There are caveats. If manufacturing trade between Europe and the rest of the world is declining, relatively speaking, but trade in services and, say, trade in high-end manufacturing is displacing conventional or low-end manufacturing trade, you could still have a very strong argument for an optimal currency area. But there's no evidence that I can see that actually countries like, I accept the arguments on graphs about unit labour costs and, you know, structural reforms and all this kind of stuff. But actually the substance tells a completely different story, which is that these countries, you know, frankly, are not in the same boat as, you know, German Mittelstand and the efficiency and high levels of manufacturing in that country. I don't think they can compete in the same way. The only other caveat that there might be for the currency area is if the politics of creating a United States of Europe actually, to coin a phrase, actually was the single goal that everybody was absolutely committed to and prepared to sacrifice everything towards, and then it really wouldn't matter any more than it matters whether Scotland or Wales, you know, have good exports to the, you know, to the rest of the United Kingdom and so on. But, you know, that's not going to happen. So it does matter, but maybe, you know, not immediately.
Thomas, are the policy prescriptions of this Eurozone shadow state the problem, or is the problem the inability of countries to actually adopt them?
I think the shadow state construction came out of the inability of the countries to adopt these policy prescriptions, which makes the construction of the shadow state a self-defeating exercise. I hope that I'm sufficiently clear. Had they been able to adopt the necessary economic policies that would have made them fit to live in this quasi gold standard, we would not have seen the emergence of the Euro shadow state. The Euro shadow state emerged because leading politicians, and I think it was mainly driven by Mrs. Merkel, thought that they could do what the market failed to do, namely force these countries to become more flexible, rein in their deficits, and so forth. She is of the view that the shadow European government can do this. The shadow government is the European Council. And my criticism is that this is a flawed assessment. She will not be able to do, or she and her government, the European Council, will not be able to do what the market couldn't do. This is why I see this effort doomed.
Thank you. Holger, is it possible or even wise for other Eurozone countries to try and emulate Germany? After all, this year Germany's current account surplus is going to be around 6.5% of GDP. if the first half data are anything to go by, just over 6.5% over the first half. So up on last year marginally. This suggests an economy with some pretty big structural problems. Indeed, could the rest of the world even accommodate a Europe remodelled in Germany's image?
I don't think that other countries have to become like Germany. What they have to do is they have to be able to live within their own means. You can be inefficient and live within your means. You can be efficient and live beyond your means, like the US. This is not a question of becoming like Germany. This is a question basically of returning to some fiscal discipline so that there are no spillover effects from fiscal deficits or shortcomings in one region of the Eurozone to the other. That's the end state. That's where we are going. That's where all this is heading. Installing some fiscal discipline within the Eurozone. It is not about becoming like Germany. And as to the German position, it's worth mentioning, of course, that the German trade surplus with the Eurozone has collapsed dramatically. That is, within the Eurozone, Germany is doing its full share of the adjustment. It is that, like Italy, Portugal, which are raising their exports to non-Europe rapidly, Germany has also, over the last few years, managed to raise its exports to non-Europe as well.
Thank you. Right, I'm now going to open up to the floor. If you'd like to ask a question, if you catch my eye, give your name and affiliation, and do try and keep the questions relatively short. Gentleman here at the front.
John Palmer, I wonder if I could ask Holger to respond specifically to what I thought was the very strong points made by both Paul and George, that the net effect of this existing policy in which you see so many optimistic trends has been enormously to increase indebtedness of those countries, made it much worse. My question is, in your view, does that not matter? Or in your view, is some deus ex machina factor going to cause it to disappear and go into remarkable reverse? And just finally, perhaps Paul and George, you rule out debt forgiveness. Can there be an endless form of debt extension which in real terms will eventually amount to debt forgiveness, though not juridically so?
And Olaf Kramer at the end here.
thanks, Simon. Olaf Kramer from Polis Network. Thanks for a fascinating presentation. Really enjoyed it. Got a question to Paul and George as well, you know, following on from what Thomas said. I very much agree with Thomas that basically the German government believes they can maintain the shadow state and are very busy trying to work out policies which can, you know, make sort of economic coordination work via the European Council. You are pessimistic. You think it won't work. I think the government for the moment sticks to this plan. Now, the question to George and Paul is really, even if, you know, the German government manages to perfectionate, to make this coordination work via the European Council, do you think such a sort of shadow state could work in the long run? You know, what, you know, do we not need sort of shock absorbers, you know, sort of integrate, you know, other mechanisms that can respond to the fallacies of capitalism as such, or do you think what else do we, you know, such a shadow state requires to survive in the long run?
Olga, do you want to come in?
Okay, yes. Of course. Austerity hurts initially. The first thing you typically get is a recession, or at least a drop in GDP growth. And that in itself makes the debt to GDP ratio worse. We've seen that significantly in the euro crisis. Having said that, however, the biggest single reason why the Eurozone had such trouble and hence such a big increase in debt to GDP in the troubled countries was this one lost year between the middle of 2011 and the middle of 2012, when the ECB was not ready, in brackets, not yet encouraged by Berlin, to step forward as the lender of last resort. This one lost year was unnecessary. It was expensive, yes. But it's in the past. Going forward, we are seeing the peripheral economies return to growth.
for most of them, that will eventually suffice to bring down the debt-to-GDP ratios from the likely end 2013 peak. Where it does not suffice, well, we have the European mechanisms. If need be, interest rates, repayment periods for the official loans to Greece will become so generous that Greece can bear them. There will not be, unless something goes seriously wrong, a write-down of the nominal value of official debt, but if these countries stay on track, we have the means within the eurozone to make it affordable. And the average actually matters a lot, because the average for the eurozone tells us that the stronger parts of the eurozone have all the means to support the weak ones, if need be, without overstretching themselves. The political will to do so on the stronger parts of the eurozone, Germany, is there.
Paul, do you want to come back on Olaf's question about the shadow state?
Yes, but can I first react a little bit on what
okay, yeah,
Paul
just
said?
Yeah.
I mean, look at the debt ratios of these countries now. Portugal had 60%, now it's 130% of GDP. Spain had 40%, is fastly moving beyond 100%. Nothing is stopping this today. Nothing is stopping this today. Greece is now back at 180%. And you are saying, well, I'm seeing growth in these countries. It's still negative. Right? It's still negative in these countries. How is growth going to make sure that these countries can get out of this problem? When you look at the relation between interest rate and growth rate, they are still very far from this. I think there's a lot of wishful thinking in your analysis. We can pray. It's like, let's pray that growth comes. Yes, and if growth comes, then we solve it. Let's pray that Germany will take its responsibility. Yes, then we can solve it. But I don't think praying will help us. Then can I
yes, of course,
go
yeah,
into that? Maybe you want to. Yeah, I think when I liked Thomas's shadow state analysis, but I do think that this cannot work. I mean, we agree on this,
yes.
Right? In fact, this was your point. So then the question is, what can make it work? Right? That's your question. And then I think that, yes, as Holger stressed, there has been an important change. The ECB has become, has recognized the need to become a lender of last resort. That has been a key change in the system that has stabilized, at least in the short run, financial markets. Right? This was necessary that the ECB did that. But it's not sufficient. It's certainly not sufficient, and what we will have to do in the long run is that we have to make a country. I mean, the euro is a currency without a country, and that cannot last. So we have to make a country at the European level. But there is no willingness to do that today. There is zero willingness to do that today. So that's why I'm pessimistic about the future of the euro. I don't believe in the scenario that Thomas created. It's nice econ of fiction, but I don't think the eurozone will split into, say, a northern and a Latin one. First of all, the Latin countries have no incentives whatsoever to stick together. I cannot see why they want to stay together. So if there is an unraveling, it will be unraveling at a national level again. Countries doing their own thing. Even in the north, you correctly mentioned that the eurozone, in fact, is a kind of commodity or even gold standard system, right? Where you impose rules on balance of payments, discipline, and all that. But in modern democracies, this cannot work, because governments have responsibilities vis-à-vis unemployed, for example, and therefore they cannot allow the rules of the gold standard to be implemented. And that also holds for the north of Europe. They may, for a while, stick together and have a kind of gold standard mechanism, but surely at some point they will be hit by exactly the same problems as southern European countries have experienced, and therefore, and at that moment, they will let down the gold standard mechanism that is politically has become unacceptable for modern states. That's why you reject it. That's why the gold standard was abandoned many decades ago. The Eurozone was an attempt to resuscitate the gold standard, giving it another name, but it's condemned for the same reason to let it fall. So therefore, I'm a little bit pessimistic. I think the whole thing could unravel, but certainly not along the lines that Thomas was telling us, that there would be two zones, monetary zones in Europe.
George, did you want to come back very quickly on Olaf's point?
Well, yes, I was also getting quite agitated here. So I'd also just actually answer your question about the debt, actually, but also to address Holger's, with respect, slightly delusional point, actually. You say, you know, that it's all down to one lost year because of the failure to anticipate and to handle the Greek restructuring. I mean, Europe had a classic 1930s-style balance of payments crisis, which, you know, suddenly the flow of capital abruptly stopped and reversed, and huge quantities of private debt, excessive private debt, have suddenly become public in the same way as happened in Japan. And you can see there that, you know, Japan's public debt, you know, in the beginning of 1989, 1990, 1991, was about 70% of GDP. It's now 250% of GDP. So without a kind of radical change in the way that Europe goes about its business, that's really what's going to happen to southern European countries, their debt-to-GDP rate, to answer your question directly. I mean, if we kind of do this extend and pretend and extend and pretend ad nauseam, what's going to happen is that Europe will just become a zombie state, keeping alive, you know, the debt positions of governments and private sector agents that are simply unrecoverable. So I'm not sure. You know, you might be right that, you know, there is the default for sure. Debt forgiveness or, you know, debt restructuring, I can't really see that there's a willingness to do that, like you. But actually, I can't really see any way out of it. I mean, it will happen in the end, because that's the only way that these huge debts can be financed and basically eventually managed. So, you know, there is just kind of a fundamental kind of disequilibrium in the Eurozone about debt management, and it's not going to go away just because there's a little cyclical bounce in the economy due to stock building and, you know, kind of structural changes in the fiscal balance for 1 year. So the structural problems underneath and the politics of it really just make this completely intractable, in my view.
Thank you. I'm going to take two questions from the back. Actually, first it's the gentleman behind you in the red shirt, and then I'll take a question from you, sir.
Hi, Nick Taylor from the University of Warwick. This is a question for the final speaker, Holger. I also happen to believe that Thatcher and Schroeder worked very well, but I also like to add a second question to that, which is for whom? Because obviously it makes a difference if you wake up tomorrow morning as a banker in the City of London or a public sector worker in Liverpool or someone on a €1 job in Berlin, say. And I think with that driving question, and if we turn it towards the question of growth and what you were talking about, imminent recoveries, and one of the examples that you had there was Ireland, and this is often touted as a kind of just round the corner country. But what if we ask, what's the difference between GDP and GNP in Ireland? What is actually growing in Ireland? It's a couple of big tech companies and pharmaceuticals. Emigration, poverty has increased, child poverty, homelessness, etc. So for whom is this not an important question?
Thank you. Malcolm Levitt, Craig Gavin Anderson. George Magnus focused on the problems, the endemic long-term structural problems facing Europe, and Helga had a rather optimistic outlook. Turning to first question of competitiveness, European countries can compete better in the world if they sell things more cheaply than the competition. Is this realistic? They can sell things of superior quality, apart from Germany especially. Is that a realistic prospect for much of the rest of Europe? Then we've got the fundamental issue of technological progress, one of the main spurs of economic growth. It means making new things, it means producing things in newer ways, a result of superior skills, research and development. Europe has, on the whole, a pretty poor record in those respects. So what is the realistic prospect for any improvement there? Competitiveness, I've talked of prices, quality and technological progress, and Europe's track record is poor. May I just take a moment to give an anecdote? Some years ago, I led a review of every sector of the Portuguese economy. There were €2 billion to be spread in Europe. We reviewed every sector. One which seemed a potential winner, ceramics. People go on holiday, they like Portuguese pottery. We sent a team of people to interview the major retailers across Europe about Portuguese ceramics. They said they're nice designs, poor quality, they break, the logistics for delivery is rotten, marketing is rotten. We gave our report to the European Commission, a lot of recommendations of this kind where improvements needed to be made, and it was buried and nothing happened at all. They wanted to spend money. They didn't want to dig down into the details of what needed to be done.
Olga, growth for whom?
Growth for whom? Again, I lived in this country in the early years of Maggie Thatcher. At that time, I was struck how poor this country was. After all, I came from defeated Germany. Yeah? I was struck how much living standards in my home were better than across this country. Having returned to this country in the mid-1990s a lot on business and travelled it, this country has been vastly transformed in what I can see as average living standards. What I can see for Germany, for whom? Schröder, the reforms. The number of well-paid jobs in Germany is up a lot. The number of average jobs in Germany is up a lot. Yes, the number of low-paid jobs is also up significantly, but most of these people did not even have a job before. So on balance, the labour market reforms have benefited almost everybody. That's my answer to that German issue. Now, Paul, I just, of course, as to these, let's pray. Yes, of course, I do pray that the good things happen.
And does it
very
help?
Much.
And I hope is that your
actually,
experience?
As a devout Catholic, I hope it helps. But the experience of the last 12 months is clearly, ever since the ECB filled this one big gap in the institutional structure of Europe, there are other smaller gaps, ever since, everything has gone the right way. As I said, on the data we have, Greece, Ireland, Portugal returned to quarterly growth in the second quarter, and ultimately, to make debt bearable or reduce the need for interest rate and maturity concessions by the official creditors, we need growth in the periphery. It's starting to happen, but it's tough. We need more time.
It's a very city view. It's what the financial services industry wants us everybody to believe, because it's a cyclical bounce. It's nothing more than that. There is no evidence of a turnaround in the dynamic and the driver of growth.
Everything has improved. What about unemployment? It's continuing to increase.
And debt.
The debt to GDP, is it continuing to increase? It's on an explosive path. And you say everything. That's what you said, right? Everything is improving.
We are economists. We know monetary policy works with a lag of about three quarters. It has. Three quarters after the ECB filled the gap, the economy started to turn up. We also know that unemployment is a lagging indicator of the business cycle. The increase in unemployment and the periphery has slowed down. But standard economics tells us it will take until early next year for unemployment actually to pass its peak. Can't do much about it.
The IMF says that Spanish unemployment will be 25% in 2018, if you please. How does that square with...
Beware of something like standard economic theory. Standard economic theory said prior to the crisis, a crisis is not possible. That's what standard economic theory was telling us.
I knew I would end up refereeing this. Would any of you like to come back on Malcolm Levitt's point about what is going to drive European growth going forward? What is Europe going to be good at?
Right. What's going to drive European growth is not... with respect, Holger, is not what the cyclical position during the next 6 to 9, 12 months is going to look like. I mean, I accept, you know, everybody has revised upwards their expectations of growth. There will be positive growth all over Europe in the second half of this year, small, and perhaps a little bit more in 2014. Actually, the biggest revisions are for the UK, which looks like the kind of star performer, but for reasons which are a little bit suspect, but hey-ho, that's, you know, for another day. But you know, the point really is, what are you going to get to get... How are you going to get sustainable growth in southern Europe? Not just cyclical, you know, restocking and stuff like that. How are you going to get sustainable growth, not just from crushing demand and, you know, getting most of your balance of payments improvement from, you know, suppressed levels of income formation and from, and, you know, bearing in mind the structural backdrop, you know, demographic change is weighing on growth, poor competitiveness, according to the kind of criteria which the gentleman at the back kind of said before, it was not just about labour cost competitiveness, but competitiveness in high-end manufacturing, in services, in technology and innovation, where, you know, southern Europe is very, very poor relative to the north. Those are the kinds of things where you're going to get growth. And so you've got to think outside the box a little bit, to quote a phrase, you know, to kind of think about how you're going to structurally change the economy and not just basically get them to perform better according to a very limited economic agenda.
Jeremy Warner.
Yes, Jeremy Warner, Daily Telegraph. We have a German election next week, and there's still a little bit of an assumption in financial markets that once she's safely re-elected, Angela Merkel will do the right things to bring about a more sustainable monetary union, you know, a proper banking union, maybe even eventually a little bit of debt mutualisation, despite the fact that these things will require treaty changes. She won't do it all at once. She'll do it in her characteristic little step sort of way. I'd like to ask the two German members of the panel what chances they think of that happening.
And the gentleman down here.
Why can't a non-German say anything about this? I don't know how I do it. It's fine.
My name's John Stevens. I'd just like to ask Paul de Groover. He said that the Thatcher revolution involved a very major devaluation. And in fact, that is not the case at all. You had a period of significant sterling overvaluation through most of the 80s. And at the beginning of the process of change in the 80s, yeah, that was extreme. So, I mean, he's actually completely wrong on that. But it does beg the question for those. I mean, I agree entirely with Holger Schmieding's analysis, essentially, of the Eurozone at the moment. But it does seem to me that one aspect which the critics of the present situation are not discussing is the Eurozone external exchange rate. And I just wonder if they could comment on whether they believe or what the impact would be were there to be a very substantial devaluation of the euro against other currencies.
Thomas, Germany.
Thank you very much. And I'm happy to comment on Germany because it seems that everyone is either in full agreement about my 2020 scenario or thinks it's completely lunatic and therefore not even worth mentioning anymore.
I think it's just too clever.
I don't expect any change, quite frankly. If we get a grand coalition, which would be at least a different composition of ruling parties, I think they will continue on the European policy basically as they did before. The trades between the CDU and the SPD will be made on domestic policy, i.e. the CDU will increase top income tax rates, they will introduce more labor restrictions, minimum wage, temporary work restrictions, and so on. They will just do it on the domestic side, so no change. They will not get euro bonds, Mrs. Merkel has said, not as long as I live. So when she is chancellor, she will not agree to that. I would like also to take up the second question on the exchange rate, mm-hmm. because it seems to me we have not really addressed this very well here. There is a fundamental exchange rate problem within the eurozone. The fictitious Deutschmark is grossly undervalued, and the Latin currencies, are grossly overvalued, and the exchange rate of the euro in the market reflects this average that Paul has characterized of a river that can be very deep and not deep at all. This is what the exchange rate reflects. So therefore, it doesn't suit really anyone, really. And what we have been discussing in the course of this of the last hour or so, I think, is also the need for a very significant real exchange rate change within Europe, which you can only engineer through relative price changes. And here comes the catch that I see here, basically creating a fundamental problem for the euro. If the Latin part of the euro area is not able to deflate, and if the central part is not able to inflate, we're stuck. We're stuck with 6.5% current account surpluses in Germany, which lead to current account surpluses for the eurozone overall when we squeeze the Latins to eliminate their deficits. It's not working. I'm not a born euro pessimist. I came to this conclusion that it's not working observing economic policies in the course of 2012. I also think the conclusion that they have drawn, which I call making the ECB to a state central bank, which Holger says is giving the ECB the lender of last resort for government function. That's the same. I'm only using a different terminology. This will basically lead to a monetary policy that has to be designed to the needs of the weakest link. By definition, whatever it takes, we don't want to have anyone exit. This has to be far too loose for Germany. It has to create either asset or CPI inflation in Germany. And this will be the rupture in the future. As I said, we have moved away from this high drama of the gold standard, and we have gone over in looking for a rupture through an unwanted reflation of Germany and others who hate inflation. Why not? I would like to take up two points that that Paul made. Why not individual national currencies? I don't think that we will go back to that, because everyone, when he ponders this question, what can we do to rescue Europe, so to speak, will have the Swiss or Danish experience in mind. In our world of large blocks and free capital movement, if you adopt a small currency, you're basically the slave of your big neighbor, and you have to import their policies, something that I believe the UK will find out when their policies diverge somewhat from the others. The Swiss definitely have found out. That's why I believe you can form new arrangements among like-minded, I call it, like-minded. This refers, the like-mindedness refers to trade and value-added creation. When you look at trade and value-added creation, you find that there is a central European value-added chain. Germany has a lot of trade relations with Central Europe, Poland, Czechia, and so on and so forth. Very intense trade. Very little trade of Germany and, let's say, Portugal. In any case, with the Latins, less. The Latins, on the other hand, have also strong relations. France and Italy, for instance, strongly interlinked, also with direct company linkages. This is why I think you can make the case that we don't go back to national currencies when that system becomes unsustainable, but we just form new currency arrangements that reflect these trade and economic links, that also reflect similar views about the welfare state. Paul said, a gold standard and democracy is inconsistent. I want to contradict to this, Paul, because in the 19th century, I would give the US and the UK the quality of democracies, and they were members of the gold standard. I would rather rephrase it and say certain ideas about the welfare state and the gold standard are inconsistent. If your idea of the welfare state is that everyone maximizes what he can get out of the state, but is not willing to pay in, if that's the idea of the welfare state, and then you have politicians who support that views. You have chronic fiscal deficits, and when you cannot fund the fiscal deficit on the market, you have continuous monetary policy support. That was what happened in many countries that are now members of the euro in the past. When you have what I would say the enlightened welfare state of most clearly in the of the Scandinavian type where people pay in to get what they take out. You are in a position where you do not need permanent monetization of government deficits. That is the feature of the first type. So I think also in the terms of how people feel about welfare states, how the welfare state works, there is a big divide. I'm not saying that Central Europe has more, has the idea of the enlightened welfare state, but they are more like Scandinavians. There's more willingness to pay in for what you get take out. My experience, without hoping to insult anyone, is that there is a prevalence in some countries in Europe that actually you have to get out a lot. This is your objective, and you have to minimize your payments in. So this is like when you have insurance. You know, you want to have damage, but you don't want to pay the premium. And if the policies accommodate that, you have a different type of system. And this is where I see the divide, and this is why I eventually think that there are commonalities, what I call the Central and Northern European countries, and their commonalities in the Latin countries. And this is why I think you can actually form different blocks to avoid that we all become basically subjects to the Chinese and American currency blocks, subjects in the sense of slaves.
I would love to keep going, but I'm afraid we have run out of time. I'm very sorry to those of you who wanted to ask questions and haven't been able to. I don't think I need to say that a lot hinges on which of these economists are going to be right about the future. Clearly, if the Eurozone as a whole, and the debtor states in particular, stagnate, and we see funding crises, then popular faith in European integration could dissipate. We could see damage not only to the euro, but to the EU, to the single market. Conversely, if this is the start of a sustained recovery in economic activity, then the outlook could be much, much brighter. Now, I'd like to have a round of applause first for all four contributors. I'd like to thank you all for coming. There are copies of this report outside that you're free to take. If they run out, then they can be downloaded from the website of the CER, which is www.cer.org.uk, and they're free, as is everything on our website. Thank you very much.